And one rises up with the chirp of a crow. The musical daughters have all been made low. They shall be afraid of the things which are high, and terrors are many in journeying nigh. Terrors are many in journeying nigh. That's Ecclesiastes parts of verses 4 and 5 of Ecclesiastes chapter 12 of the Ward Green version from 2004, Little Children, our daily scripture for today. And now, I would like to talk a little bit about my screen protector, because the screen protector that I got when I first bought my phone, I knew nothing about screen protectors. I did not understand that it was made of tempered glass. That is, that the screen protector was also tempered glass. Or I didn't know what the iPhone glass was made of either, because I just bought the iPhone for the first time at that time. I was more or less forced to buy one because they wouldn't let, or to buy some kind of phone because they wouldn't let me do anything else. Once I was taking my wife to live at the old, you know, the retirement home, or old folks' home, where all the older people live, they required that I have a phone, like a mobile phone, so that I could be reached at any time. That's what they said. Now, I mean, they didn't probably understand that I was not out and about. I was almost always at home, but they had to be able to reach me in case there was an emergency. And that's why that was a requirement. So I bought my iPhone 6S in August of 2016. I believe that was the exact month at that time. Didn't understand what it was, really. I spent about $1,000 on it, but it was paid by installment. But they, at the time, sold me a screen protector and a case, too, but, you know, to protect the phone. I just bought everything I needed, but I also bought an iPad at that time, too. It was an iPad Air. It was the Air 2, it turned out, but that iPad served me well, and when the battery started getting a little not so good, a year or two ago, I bought another iPad, so I've got two of those working. They both work. I've got the iPhone. My iPhone 6S has actually never been glued back together. After I replaced the battery, I never glued it back together because I want to be able to get into it again. So it's always falling apart, and, you know, it's always coming apart. Every time I use it, I have to push it back together again. Every time I put it in the camera stand or whatever, and every time I pick it up or take it out of my pocket, or I have to constantly push it back together, it doesn't stay together completely, so it's kind of like in pieces almost, and still runs perfect so far. But so it's from 2016, just like the screen protector was. So that screen protector lasted me 8 years, but it was very thin, because the new ones I ordered, I did not know how thick the old one was, or didn't check into all, couldn't possibly understand all of that. The new screen protectors are, I got three of them in a group, a batch or whatever, you know, in one box, and they're thicker. So if that one lasted me 8 years, then, you know, at the same rate, in the same use case, this one would last me, since it's thicker. And we know strength goes as the cube of thickness. This one's almost twice as thick, maybe. I don't know. It might be 8 times stronger, so it might last me 64 years. Just kidding, but, you know, that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing you know when you know about the strength and its relationship to thickness as it relates to a force exerted in the same direction as thickness, right? It's kind of a tensile strength in a way, because but it's compressing one side and tensing the other side when you bend something. It goes as the cube of the thickness, right? Whereas all other tensile strength, like if you have a thread and you make the cross-sectional area twice as big, it's going to be twice as strong because it's pounds per square inch. Every square inch, you double the square inches if you double the area. So cross-sectional area, if you double that, you double tensile strength in terms of stretching strength. But when it comes to bending strength, you double that height or the thickness in the same direction as the force. That thickness that goes in the same direction as the direction of the force you're applying. You double that thickness, it's 8 times the strength. That's the difference here. That's the remarkable thing that I learned quite late in my engineering life, let's say, or career, if you can call it a career. But the timeline in the Arc of Urartu, Chapter 2, Paragraph 11, is very well anchored by two time alignments. Chinese history, what is otherwise a mythology with dates, aligned with Kehinen, the grandson of Shem, by genealogy, and Semiramis, former wife of Assyrian king Ninus, aligned with Ara, the handsome, in a famous Armenian legend. Since we are dealing with dates without a mirror, as dates reflecting the same numbers have yet to arrive in 2011 CE, which was apparently when I was writing some of this article. Anyway, I'm not sure. I thought this was written in 2010, this article. For comparison, we can't give a mirror date in the BCE years to our current date that's older than 2024 today, because 2024 is our year today right now of the Common Era. So in the BCE years 2024, that would be our mirror date. We can't talk about 2025 in the mirror of BCE years because we haven't reached 2025 yet. So we resort instead to the principle whereby we look for truth in a multitude of counselors, Proverbs 11 and 14, talking about wisdom in the multitude of counselors, or salvation in the multitude of counselors, which is a proverb that comes up more than once in Proverbs. I don't know. You've got to ask Joe Two Rivers. That was a saying from the series on ancient television, it seems like now, from the TV show Forest Rangers, which was a Canadian outdoor adventure series. We'd watch every week. We'd see another episode of this Forest Rangers television show. And, you know, we learned, I think there was a Native Indian, a Native Canadian, or a Native North American Indian, who was called Joe Two Rivers, and he was the one they used to get some information from with regard to some wise things that he knew. And so that's why the saying came about. I don't know. They would say that. I don't know. You've got to ask Joe Two Rivers. If they didn't know something, they would ask him. So that was kind of the multitude of counselors. In other words, you know, you'd always resort to ask someone else, or in this case, they had a good counselor they could turn to. In the genealogy of Mr. Coronazzi, changing the dates for Nimrod or Hake likewise affects the date of Ninus and Ara. We kind of mentioned that yesterday. There is yet another line which we have not considered in complete agreement with these three lines of Hake, Shelah, and Nimrod. It is Phineas Pharsa, whom we also have mentioned as relating to the Gaelic alphabet, and as one of the builders of that tower, it says here, and after the confusion of the languages, a creator of the Phoenician alphabet therefrom. And that account proves the lineages. It helps us by having this additional character, Phineas Pharsa, who's in the Irish nation records from, for example, the book by John O'Hart, The Stem of the Irish Nation, Irish Pedigrees, which goes from Adam down to Milesius of Spain. And it includes, and also, I have some links there to that book, but they're probably, well, they're either broken or they're not, I'm not sure, but you can find that book online, or almost certainly you can find it somewhere, Irish Pedigrees by John O'Hart. So in that book, he mentions Phineas Farsa. He's in the descent line of the Irish people. And he dates all the way back to the Tower of Babel. That's the thing about Phineas Farsa. Dates as far back as the Tower of Babel. And in our table, which we found rather useful, that was actually from Moses Koronatsis' book, History of the Armenians, pages 74 and 75, edited by Robert W. Thompson of Harvard University in 1978. We found Phineas Farsa as the fourth in descent from Noah's son Japheth, including Japheth, or the fourth from Noah, excluding Noah, or the fifth including Noah, right? So Noah, Japheth, Magog, Boaz, and Phineas Farsa, the fifth on that list, starting with Noah. So he's very early in the descent line from Noah, right? But they lived a long time, these people, and that's how it can be 500 years after the flood when the Tower of Babel was actually built. And still, since their generations were at least 100 years between the birth of their sons and the next generation, each generation was quite long, according to the Septuagint version. That's where we have to use the Septuagint to get that result. Otherwise, we wouldn't get that result. Our Septuagint agreed with the Chinese, though, in their chronology. And that was independent agreement. So, you know, we had this remarkable alignment with this person, Qi Yu, who was exactly a great correspondence to Nimrod, who was the first one who is called a mighty one in the earth, as Qi Yu was this incredible master of weaponry and a mighty one in the Chinese mythology. So he corresponded to Nimrod. We have this, it's extremely rough and crude. It's a crude correspondence that we have, but it's actually remarkably, tremendously accurate as well, considering how long ago these things are. The fact that there's any alignment at all is quite a miracle. In our artwork, we've got this beautiful little painting called the Little Tower of Babel from approximately, or circa, 1564 by Peter Bruegel the Elder. Haven't looked at this in its blown up state for a while. There it is. In its enlarged version, we see it's sort of a cropped version of the Tower of Babel. And the way that the Flemish painters painted these ancient buildings is not really necessarily close to the way they were actually constructed, and some people think that the Tower of Babel was actually a ziggurat, and that it wasn't very tall. There are differing views about that. You know, whether they were trying to build it to reach the clouds and go above the clouds is a different idea, or another idea about that, how high they were intending to go with it. But on the original site in Babylon, where they have the ruins of it, they've probably got the ruins of more than one structure there, or possibly anyway, as I think about it right now. They typically find, like with Noah's house, they found on the site of Noah's house, which was at a fairly modest, reasonable distance from Noah's Ark in Turkey, they found the ruins of a building that had been built on top of Noah's house, which was then a church or some kind of a place of worship. And people would bring their ashes there as well. They found that. I was watching a video yesterday, which was by a gentleman from New Zealand who's a scholar of some kind, or he's not a professor, not a doctor with a PhD, but he's some kind of an expert, and he was he made a video, but he was on the site of Noah's Ark. He's been there, and he studied these things regarding Noah's Ark, including Noah's house. He talked about also the burial place of Noah's wife and things like that. He talked about what happened when people found treasure in the grave. Then they tore apart Noah's house. Actually, they tore apart probably the place that had been built on top of Noah's house. But afterwards, when the government got involved, the government of Turkey, they came in and excavated. And Noah's house actually went deeper in the ground because soil had been, you know, deposited by storms or whatever, you know, erosion from the hillside, and had buried some parts of the walls so that they could dig down and reveal the original or older walls of the structure. So they do have some, you know, ancient, even very ancient, they have some, what are the words? They have vestiges, anyway, of what they believe is Noah's house. And on top of that was built something else. So just like with, and maybe we should, if we have time, we should watch that video sometime too. I just can't recall where it is here in on my list of videos, whether I shut it down or whether it's still here. Not sure where it is. I don't think I have it there right now. But it's in my history. I can find it. I think, what was his name? I can't remember his name now either, but I think it was Patterson or something like that. Might have been his name. But he has other people working with him, and they all study Noah's Ark, and there are scholars in Turkey who study Noah's Ark. Right? And so on the site, it's actually, I was going to say before, but it's after Noah's Ark, right? The Tower of Babel was built after the Ark landed, 500 years later. But they've got this, they don't have what this painting shows here. This is a painting by Peter Bruegel, but they have the actual Ark site. And they have, I should say, what I meant to say was, what's that? That's interesting. Well, that's Noah's Ark. Yeah, right. By Samuel Windsor. They have the remnants of the Tower of Babel, is what I was trying to say. They have the Tower of Babel, and they have possibly a lot of other structures that were built on it later on. And I think, well, there's some kind of artwork showing Naram Sin rebuilding the Tower of Babel. I believe that's what some of the artwork shows in the Akkadian history. But, I mean, so there may have been many structures built on top of the Tower of Babel, so we shouldn't be too overly insistent on any one idea there, but about what the structure was like. That's the thing. But it would be worth investigating, wouldn't it? I think it would. Even further, if we could. Finding out more about what is there. But, you see, there are so many things to investigate, aren't there? Just so many. I mean, Ron Wyatt discovered also the places he believed he discovered where Sodom and Gomorrah was. But then someone else recently has pointed out that the place that where Ron found it at the south of the Dead Sea, there's a place at the north of the Dead Sea, which they think fits better with the Bible account of where Lot went to live when he separated from Abraham in the Bible account of Lot and Abraham. And that's been investigated also. So there's so many things to study, aren't there? Now let's continue our viewing of, this is episode 12 now, of the Ra Expeditions 1972 movie, The Expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl.
Was afloat, and the starboard mast lost its support, so we had to take down the sail. The situation was critical.
After a turbulent 3 days of thrashing about in the 20-foot waves of a storm, and desperately trying in the storm to make contact with the Shenandoah, the crew of Ra joyfully sight the little yacht.
Everyone was firmly determined to continue. There was only 1 week sailing more if we rigged up a small sail on the bundles that were still undamaged. But I was the one responsible, and the experiment was not worth the risk of human lives. 2 days later, I decided to let the remains of Ra drift on alone, and we moved over to the Shenandoah.
Their first thought, as they move over to the Shenandoah, is to salvage the film equipment and everything that cannot withstand water. Before they abandon Ra, they cut down the heavy mast and take off everything that can be salvaged.
To the deck of the Shenandoah was landed plenty of food and water from the Ra. Before the seven of us, with our monkey and our duck, had transferred over, we had hoisted a makeshift sail on the papyrus boat. It was sad to abandon Ra so close to our goal. Despite all our beginner's mistakes, Ra was still afloat after 2 months, not just for 2 weeks. Their lasting friendship had arisen during the 8 weeks aboard the papyrus bundles, but none of us dreamed that within 10 months we would be sailing together again on Ra 2. Ra 1 continued alone toward America.
That was it. Okay, so let's continue with part 2 of this Ra Expeditions, part 2 now.
Heyerdahl is determined to try again. And this time, shipwrights, he goes to Lake Titicaca, where there have been reed boats with sails from time immemorial.
Let's go back.
Reed boats.
Start again.
Heyerdahl is determined to try again. And this time, in order to find his shipwrights, he goes to Lake Titicaca, where there have been reed boats with sails from time immemorial. Reed boats are still being built here better than anywhere else in modern times. These boats are astonishingly similar to ancient Egyptian boats, for they have raised sterns as well as raised prows. 2 fat reed bundles lashed together with a continuous spiral rope form the main hull of the vessel. Squeezed in between the two is a 3rd smaller bundle, wedged into the lashings and disappearing as the main rope is pulled tighter. Such South American boats are astonishingly similar to those once built 5,000 years ago in ancient Egypt.
Santiago Genovese visited these Aymara Indians to find boat builders willing to come with us to Morocco in Africa and help to build Ra 2. 4 Indians agreed to come together with a Bolivian interpreter. They expected to find Africa on the other side of their own lake.
They must believe a magic carpet has flown them to Safi in Morocco in a matter of hours. From this ancient Phoenician port, Thor Heyerdahl has sailed the previous year. Now he wants the Indians to build Ra 2 from 12 tons of papyrus reeds he has transported from Lake Tana in Ethiopia. They find these reeds are even bigger and better than their own on Lake Titicaca. They rope thousands of reeds together into 2 huge bundles. Each bundle is lashed independently, using only a single spiral rope. And, as normal with them, a central bundle disappears from sight as the long ropes are pulled tight. A further bundle is added on top to each side to make a wider deck. After 6 weeks' work, Ra 2 is nearing completion. The Indians from Lake Titicaca are so eager to rejoin their families that they use only two-thirds of the available reeds. The boat they make is much smaller than Ra 1, 10 feet shorter, in fact, with far less volume than Heyerdahl has intended. Ra 2 is first launched in dry land and is navigated through the streets of Safi by Norman Baker, the expedition pilot. A ship like something out of ancient Egypt, but built by South American Indians. The wife of the local Pasha baptizes Ra 2 in goat's milk. Heyerdahl's hopes are high, but he still has the bitter memory of his previous boat having failed. Under the flag of the United Nations, Ra 2 slides down the slipway, dry as blotting paper.
She floated like a paper swan on top of the waves. After 10 days in the harbor, we left port and sailed into the open Atlantic, heavily loaded with 6 tons of cargo and superstructure. For 2 days, we drove southwards along the African coast with good wind and high speed. We made an average of 4 knots, doing 95 nautical miles in 24 hours. Although we were immensely pleased with our speed, we soon had another serious problem to worry about. Ra 2 started sinking much faster than Ra 1. Our new ship seemed to be too small for the many tons of cargo she carried. The heavy load pressed us deeper and deeper into the water. While we clipped ourselves fast with lifelines so as not to fall overboard ourselves, we started to throw away anything not desperately needed.
Okay, that's good enough for today. So that's from part two of the Ra Expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl. And that was the voice of Thor Heyerdahl, I understand, who has a rather significant Norwegian accent. And there is a picture of Thor Heyerdahl, who, of course, passed away in April of 2002 at the age of 87. This expedition began in 1969, and the movie was 1972, the movie that we're watching here. So, and we see there, as we just were watching, we saw that the boat was too small the second time around. It was sinking even faster. And I think I've seen recently, I previewed some of part two near the beginning of it, and I saw that they threw a lot of things overboard, and this apparently, as we will see, rectified their problem of the boat sinking on them. So they needed to get rid of enough weight, extra weight, that they could dispense with, that they weren't, that, you know, needing. And that was enough to solve their problem, as hopefully we'll see tomorrow. it happened very quickly in the movie. It's just in the next part. A few seconds later, they resolve their problem in the footage of that movie. So here's a picture of a ziggurat, too, at Ur. So the Babylonians, or the people who lived in that part of the world, typically built these ziggurats, such as this one at Ur, which is a reconstruction. So this, some people think, is what the Tower of Babel actually looked like. But it may well have been that these were later structures, and that the Tower of Babel may in fact have been something somewhat different from that. So that's of some of no little interest, right, to know what the Tower of Babel was like. And so tomorrow, Jehovah willing, we'll be finishing up this chapter 2 by covering the last paragraph of chapter 2, paragraph 12. And then we can, and there's some, these are actually links that work here. It's the last time I clicked them, which was just yesterday, I think. Mr. Ron Wyatt talking about the Jesus blood sample and frequently asked questions on Noah's Ark. Those are good links. They actually work. Shem, Ham, and Japheth will be chapter 3. And we see what happened with this beautiful, colorful, modified picture that I got, a map, and modified it. It was a map that I obtained and then modified. I didn't really change the colors. I just added the gradation, the shading here, that is, to separate the three regions, and added the names. That was what I did. So it shows that Japheth, actually, was the son of Noah, from whom the northern countries in general came. Shem was the son from whom the nations came, who lived in more the middle of the earth, speaking of the latitude, more the warmer regions, you know, or the, not necessarily the warmest, because we know the Sahara Desert's very hot, and it's in the region where Ham was living, in great part. So, I mean, we have all of these, I mean, the Sahara is mainly in that region, but we also have, you know, the idea that Ham lived in the southern regions, Shem lived in the more middle regions of Spain, Italy, and the Mediterranean region, and China, and all of those regions, including the Middle East, whereas Japheth was in the north, Scandinavia, Russia, and all those places. Ham was in the south, Africa, you know, India. All the darker-skinned peoples, too, generally live there. That's it for today. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we see the nine black tribe was also the sons of Mizraim, who were the Egyptian tribe, essentially, of Mizraim plus his eight sons, according to the study we already did. So that's it for today. We're a little over time, but it's September 25th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 18:25 hours North American Eastern Standard, or Daylight Time, currently, Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie. They're saying bye for now. That was the Ark of Urartu, Chapter 2, Paragraph 11.